Live from New York City, it's The Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Today, we're going to learn all about tocotrienols and breast health, where that's from an important study, and how does inflammation affect your heart, from Michael Smith, Life Extension. And then we're going to look at how legume consumption, that's your bean family, helps your glycemic control, meaning your blood sugar, and lowers your risk of heart attacks. And also how exercise boosts the satisfaction with life, from Science Daily, and a lot more on health and healing. Also today, we're going to take a look at a few other issues. We're going to look at, for example, what's happening with thousands of lives being saved if countries simply met the ATS clean air standards. And that's not difficult to do, so why aren't we doing it? I'll explain. Also, the chickenpox vaccine is now linked to shingles, the vaccine is, at the vaccination site in many children, Boston's Children's Hospital. And also, the infectious diseases of the past, well, they're poised to make a deadly comeback. Many of the medical breakthroughs of the last century could be lost through the spread of antimicrobial resistance. So doctors and hospitals urgently need new medicines. No, that's the wrong approach. We need to understand the power of the immune system for all diseases, including infectious diseases. So I'll share that with you. And then we're going to take one or two of the questions that Elizabeth has from the audience. And then I have a guest for the second part of the program. He is Professor Juan Cole. We're going to try to make sense of the recent developments and renewed aggression in the Middle East. Most people are not aware of what's going on. We'll be speaking with Professor Cole from Qatar, who is currently at odds with Saudi Arabia, United Arab Emirates, Kuwait, and other the Middle Eastern kingdoms. Why? And why should we care about what goes on in Syria today, or Iran, or anywhere else out there? Most people don't know where most of these places are and are disconnected from them. Also today, from our audio file, we're going to take a look, because we got a very positive feedback from a lot of millennials and parents of millennials, to the two-part series I did last week on what millennials need, what they don't have currently, and why that's important. And so we're going to ask a question. The question is, why is it that millennials are afraid of capitalism? Then the new poor in America. How many poor? 250 million Americans are now poor. You heard me right. When was the last time we heard about them in Congress or any of the talking heads on MSNBC or Fox or anywhere else? So we're going to take you to them. I took my camera crew and I went to meet them all across America. So in this series, you'll join me as I find the poor, speak with them, give them a chance to tell their stories so you can better understand. Oh, and if you are one of the people that generalizes that the poor must be lazy and unmotivated, well, you're in for a surprise. You're going to meet people who had MBAs, PhDs, adjunct professors, people who'd worked their whole life, honorable and decent human beings who are now homeless. So that's also in our series. So we have a lot to share today. We always start with the latest on health and healing. A good study that was from a major university in France about organic food. And why organic? Well, this major study confirms that a diet high in fruits and vegetables is better for the planet than one high in animal products. The study also finds that organic food provides a significant additional climate benefits for plant-based diets. But that's important. Why? The planet is able to capture a lot of the heat from the plant and absorb it into the soil. You're then eating the vegetables, the legumes, the nuts and seeds. Those are not polluting our waterways or our soil. They're not leaching nitrogen out of the soil, which causes a lot of erosion. So it's good on all levels. This was published in Frontiers in Nutrition. So those of you who've been eating a plant-based diet, good for you. Because when the French looked at 34,000 French adults, they found that the French used the term pro-vegetarian and determined their preference for plant-based diets over animal-based diets. Now, considering that the French have been large consumers of dairy and meat, this is a major shift. Again, it's a sampling, and it's important. From the National Institutes of Aging, published in the Journal of the American Medical Association, exercise with calcium, vitamin D, is linked to fewer injuries and fewer falls. And this was a meta-analysis, meta meanings many. They looked at many studies and found that those who exercise on a daily basis and those who also consume vitamin D, calcium, magnesium, are less likely to have fractures, have stronger bones. Also, from the Salt Institute, minutes after you eat a meal, as nutrients rush into your bloodstream, your body makes massive shifts in how it breaks down and stores fats and sugars. And within half an hour, your liver has made a complete switch, going from burning fat for energy to storing as much glucose or sugar as possible. But the speed at which this happens has puzzled scientists. It's too short a time span for the liver cells to activate genes and produce the RNA blueprints needed to assemble new proteins to guide metabolism. Now the Salk researchers have uncovered how the liver can have such a speedy response to food. Liver cells store up pre-DNA molecules involved in glucose and fat metabolism. So that means that your body is able to do this, your liver is able to do it. Here's my problem with this. They did not study what is the impact of a high-fat diet, that's the average American diet, high-sugar diet, that's also the average American diet, on the liver. There was a time when you only really had a problem with liver conditions like cirrhosis of the liver, if you were drinking a lot of alcohol, or any form of infection like hepatitis that would impact the liver, elevated liver enzymes. Now upwards of 40% of the adult population have non-alcoholic fatty liver disease. Now, the only thing that's important is that the liver can rejuvenate about 60% of itself, but at a big cost, and the older you get, the more difficult that becomes. I remember once when I was having a conversation with Nicholas Gonzalez, a late physician who had a background in immunology, but practiced more often than not cancer therapy. Nicholas was a good guy. And he was a student of anything that worked. He was very eclectic. And he said he didn't like to take patients who'd had chemotherapy because he could not get that liver rejuvenated. Well, he's not alone in that feeling. More and more, we're understanding that the more good you do your liver, the better that liver is going to act on your behalf. Remember, everything that goes in the body has to be processed through that liver. It is the central metabolism factory, but it's also the detoxification factory. It takes toxins and takes them out of the liver and through the bloodstream and then through the urine or feces, or it brings nutrients in and assembles them so your body can use them. So it's doing two things simultaneously. When you're on a high-fat, high-sugar diet, it has to work overtime just metabolizing the sugar and the fat. That's what this study is showing. Where then is the time to do all the proper assimilation of nutrients and the elimination of toxins? It can't do everything based upon the burden. So I would say very important, lots of green juices, lots of vegetables, eating sunflower seeds, pumpkin seeds. Also, sesame seeds and flax seeds are good for the liver. And lemon juice, apple cider vinegar, good for the liver, cleanses the liver. From the University of Kentucky is a study about the role of nutrition in influencing mechanisms involved in environmentally mediated disease. According to news reporting originating in Kentucky, human exposure to environmental contaminants such as persistent chlorinated organics and heavy metals, pesticides, phthalates and flame retardants, electronic waste and airborne pollutants, and especially in the pollutants from Southeast Asia, yeah, they're coming over the United States, and it's a significant and urgent problem, and we're not doing anything about it. First, because China won't do anything based upon anyone else telling it to do so. We want cheap Chinese goods. We want their computers. And most of the computers and telephones made in the United States are made in China. They have more essential minerals than any other country in the world. They've spent trillions of dollars over the decades having long-term leases or purchasing natural resources in other countries. And as a result, they have everything that we need to make a missile, to make a cell phone, to make a satellite, to make a flat-screen TV. They have all this. That's where it's made. So that puts them in a position to literally not care what we think and what we want. As a result, they're not changing their air quality standards for the rest of the world. They're only being forced to do so because their own inhabitants, at least a million a year, a million, are dying from airborne pollutants in China alone because of the high level of coal burning they do. So now this report shows that we end up thinking we're okay because we can't see all the pollutants, but they're there. And that causes heart disease, cancers, inflammation throughout the body, and that makes us more vulnerable to different diseases. And they're calling this environmental toxic insults. So more and more we have to be aware that people have environmental chemical sensitivities. And also from the University of Colorado, published in the peer-reviewed journal Addiction, marijuana is not as damaging to the brain as previously thought, according to new research. The research, which was published just this week, examined the brains of more than 1,000 people of varying ages and found that long-term alcohol use, even in moderation, was much more damaging to the brain than marijuana, contradicting years of research into the effects of marijuana and other cannabinoid products on the brain. Now, these findings and other conclusions suggested the potential public health benefits of marijuana come amid the recent back and forth on federal marijuana policy and the nation's opiate crisis. And yet scientists are still hesitant to say that cannabinoid usage, specifically as it pertains to marijuana and its associated products, is beneficial. Well, let me tell you something. If you have lung cancer, brain cancer, seizures, autism spectrum disorder, the cannabinoid, that is the medicinal oil, not what you would smoke, the oil, is better than any medicine on the planet. And it's non-toxic. So that's important. Also, from Harvard School of Public Health, done through their Department of Nutrition, sodas, what tens of millions of Americans consume every day and people around the world, drinking these sodas directly is associated with increased risk of cardiovascular disease. Direct link. Oh, I wished I had this study 30 years ago when I was debating the head of the American Council on Science and Health, a pro-industry group. I had all the studies I could find. I think I had 20 studies on the dangers of sugar, since she said sugar wasn't harmful. We were on Bob Kane's NBC national radio program. And I gave the best that I could as far as what the science showed. But because she was a Harvard PhD, she was given more credibility just by her pedigree. Boy, have we made mistakes trusting people based upon their pedigrees. Wow. Anyhow, according to the new report out of Boston, quote, soda intake is associated with an increased risk of cardiovascular disease. Period. There it is. You want to destroy your heart, have a heart attack, a stroke, drink soft drinks. Period. Quote, consumption of diet sodas, often considered healthy alternatives to soda, could also increase likelihood of cardiovascular outcomes. Well, I was just thinking of something. Every Wednesday or Thursday, for almost a quarter of a century, over 25 years, I would meet with my publisher and friend, and we would spend 3-4 hours together talking about different conspiracies and which ones to take on and why and what might be the outcome. And during that entire evening, all he would do would be having one diet soda after another. And I tried to explain to him. I even brought him studies on the dangers of saccharin and artificial sweeteners and aspartame and what the phosphoric acid in the diet soda would do to his hydrochloric acid in the stomach, making him far more susceptible to cancer. And even the esophageal cancer, well, you guessed it, he got esophageal cancer, throat cancer. And when we were having a conversation, he said, I should have listened. I should have listened. He didn't. Well, most people don't listen. But the evidence is there, and it's no longer a matter of debate. So stop with the soft drinks, or put yourself at risk of heart attack or stroke. And finally, curcumin, cure, C-U-R, cumin, C-A-M-I-N, dramatically reduce the risk of heart attacks and heart failure and stroke in three amazing ways. Now, this is from the CDC, and, quote, one in every four deaths is directly linked to heart disease. Okay. And the two main issues underlying this avoidable disease are chronic inflammation and excessive plaque buildup. Yet the CDC has little written about the value of natural substances like curcumin to help reduce the risk of chronic inflammation, plus much more. Now, according to Natural Health, good research database, they looked at the studies on curcumin, and which has a strong polyphenol content. It's found from turmeric. So you get the herb turmeric, which is used in curries. From the turmeric, you extract the curcumin, which is only a small part of it. And that helps slash the risks of cardiovascular disease like metabolic syndrome related and inflammation. On top of that, a simple search of PubMed, as well as over 100 studies in peer-reviewed journals highlighting the importance of curcumin as it relates to heart disease. Over 100. Has your doctor ever told you about it? No. So researchers have long known of curcumin's anti-inflammatory effects. It turns off inflammation. It reduces the pro-inflammatory cytokines, it neutralizes free radicals, and it reduces oxidative damage to cells and tissues. That allows you to live longer. That prevents stroke. That prevents heart attacks. It's that simple. It also can reduce high blood sugar. Now, mind you, when you're overweight, you're going to die sooner. You have to break this into its segments. You actually have to compartmentalize it. I wish you didn't. I wished you could deal with all of it, but people can't. So they say, well, I like myself overweight. That's fine. But you're still going to die faster, and you're not going to like it. And the trouble is we have this whole identity, social phenomena of identity politics that you can't talk about a person that's overweight and you can't talk about a person who's bulimic. And yeah, you can and you should. You should have all open, honest discussion of what the underlying problems are so you can help if a person chooses. If they don't want your help, that's fine. But what if they do need your help? What if your advice is exactly what they need to save their life? Let's go back 10 years. There's a woman who had been in 23 different psychiatrists, psychologists' offices, institutionalized. When she was brought into my office, she weighed 85 pounds. She looked like something out of a concentration camp. She just totally emaciated. And I simply ask her a question, do you want to live or do you want to die? And she didn't answer me immediately. She just sat there. And then she began to cry. And it was 10 minutes of her just sitting there and sobbing before she finally said, I think I want to live, though I realize I've been doing everything to slowly die. I said, well, why? What would you have gained by dying? And one of the things people never realize that even when we do something stupid, self-defeating, we may have a rationalization of how it's going to impact other people. Let's just say we didn't like our upbringing. Let's say we didn't like our parents. Let's say we had abusive parents. By you killing yourself slowly, you're punishing them. You're showing them contempt. In any case, I won't go through all that I did, but 1 year later, she was 130 pounds. She went on to get her PhD. She's now a board-certified clinical psychologist, and she is a professor at a major Ivy League university helping others. So when you think your advice won't matter, when it's no one's going to pay attention, they may not, but it's worth letting them know. You're overweight, you're going to die. Blood sugar elevated, that's going to hurt your heart. There is no such thing as being diabetic and overweight not hurting your heart and your blood vessels. It's one and the same. So causing people with diabetes to be 200 to 300% more likely to die of heart disease than non-diabetics, because elevated blood sugar can even lead to diabetic cardiomyopathy, an impairment of the function of the heart muscle, which can result in early heart failure and increased risk of heart attack. And by decreasing oxidative stress, curcumin prevents the glucose-induced death of heart muscle tissue, thereby decreasing cardiomyopathy risk. So it's just a superstar. So take curcumin. That's the latest on health and healing. I'm Gary Nall. We're going to take a break and come right back. Please stay with us. Nice to have you with us. Let's go over and say hello to Elizabeth, who's standing by. Hi, Elizabeth.
Hey, Gary. This is a question that comes from somebody who's anonymous. They say they recently left Wall Street. They were an attorney. Excuse me. Many years ago, they heard you criticizing the culture of Wall Street, namely their greed and their power and insecurities. I thought you were exaggerating, they say, but in fact you were understating it. And they don't know if you're aware of HSBC or Valiant, but they are the norm, they're saying.
And the question is?
It's a comment, really, I think, that they thought you were exaggerating, but you are understating what's going on in Wall Street.
Okay, let me give you an example. Hang up because I'm getting some feedback from you, and you can listen over the radio. HSBC is like Citigroup, Goldman Sachs, JP Morgan Chase. It's a big bank, huge bank, offices all over the world, but a very loosely structured bank in many respects. Because the individual banks in different countries, even though they're given a charter, they can make their own way. Now, HSBC is just a typical example of how Wall Street works and how the American corporatocracy works. I'll just use them as an example. Somewhere around 2000 to 2006, there was something strange going on at HSBC, and that's because it started to receive enormous amounts of money at individual branches, including in Mexico, that had nothing to do with legitimate business. It had almost everything to do with terrorism and drugs. And then some researchers began to look into it around 2006, and they found that it was laundering money. How much money? No one knows exactly, but the last figure I heard was about $880 million in drug money was laundered. The bank was making enormous profits, about $39 billion every 2 years. That's huge. So why would a bank knowingly take in cartel drug money? Simple, because they get to take a percentage of that for themselves. And you would think, well, wow, you could just say no. I mean, if someone comes in with, you know, giant duffel bags worth of cash, you know it's not good money. It's not clean. That's correct. In fact, just one of the individuals associated with the drug cartel, a pharmaceutical manufacturer, was purchasing an awful lot of drugs that didn't look right, because these are drugs that you could use to make methamphetamine down in Mexico and then get it into the United States. So they raided his house, something very unusual, almost never happens. In his house in Mexico City, they found over $220 million in cash, plus all the whole weapon supply, and they arrested the guy. And yet he had been a favorite in Las Vegas because he gambled. I believe they even gave him a Rolls Royce as a gift. Generally, they comp you a room or a free meal or go see a show, Wayne Newton or something. And no, they gave him a Rolls Royce. Well, wouldn't you think that with all the oversight that Las Vegas has, that if you're spending lots of money, they should be able to know where's the source of that money? But nobody cared. So then what happens in Mexico? Now, this is not unusual. This happens all over the world, all over the world. One day you're sitting in a bank and your bank manager in Mexico City. And a gentleman comes in well-dressed and he says he's opening an account and there's going to be a lot of money going into that account. And right up front, he also says that we understand that you have a mortgage of $200,000 on your home where you and your wife and three children live. Oh, and by the way, these are your three children right there. And the guy looks outside and his three children are in the back of an SUV. And the guy's freaking out. What are you doing with my children? He said, just stay calm. We're giving you a gift. Within the week, you will get a letter stating that you have a relative who died in the last 6 months, and it turns out that person was a collector of coins, and they're paying off your entire mortgage. Plus, you're going to have about $500,000 left over for you and your family, all legal, all clean. And we're going to just make sure that you have enough money for your kids to go to private schools. So you're going to have all that. But you're never to question where this money comes from, ever. Because if you do, then you don't get the silver, you get the lead. And with that, he puts seven bullets on the table. That's your wife, your mother, your wife's mother, and your children and you. Do you understand me? This is the bank manager. He's not a part of any of the drug cartels. And so he has no choice. And that's what happens everywhere, through threats. Now, why is it that that would happen in Mexico? Because remember, that's where all the money is in Mexico. Because you've got the Sinaloa cartel there. It's the single largest drug cartel in the world. And it's an unusual one because there's no one single boss. It broke itself into factions. And it works in all 17 Mexican states and throughout the United States. It goes clear around the world. And it works with the U.S. Drug Enforcement Agency. Yes, you heard me right. Our Drug Enforcement Agency actually worked with them. That was the Fast and Furious. Now, they're not the only one. We gave them protection. We let them do their drug business. We didn't raid any of their banks or safe houses, providing that they gave us some insight into the Juarez cartel, one of the oldest surviving cartels, or the Beltrán Leyva organization. By four brothers that started it, and or the Knights Templars, or the Gulf Cartel, or the Los Zetas Cartel, or the Tijuana Cartel. These are the other major cartels. There are about six major cartels, and they're doing upwards of $40 billion a year in illegal drugs. Now, that's all money. You got to do something with it. So what do? You put it in banks, and that way the bank can transfer it and put it into holding companies. It can take it into dark accounts in the Cayman Islands and then reinvest it in legitimate businesses, so it's washed it. It has cleaned up the money. That's called money laundering. But here, not just Citigroup also was engaged in this, but it was HSBC. And so it came time to bring him in. Guess who brought him in? Lanny Brewer, Eric Holder, and Roberta Lynch, the attorney general, the assistant U.S. attorney. And everybody was saying, yeah, good, got him. Remember, 90,000, remember these figures, 90,000 Americans each year go to jail for drug offenses. And sometimes just by having marijuana on them during a search and seizure, and they can be in jail for the next 7 years. We're talking about $800 million. Now, why is this important? Because you got to understand the statistics. These drug cartels are not just making money and buying themselves expensive homes on the west coast of Mexico, what they call their gilded communities, but they're killing people. How many? Well, I could include Colombia, Honduras, and San Salvador, but let's start with Mexico. Last year, the Mexican government released this data. In just 7 years, 196,000 were killed in drug wars. 76,000 were disappeared, and we assume they're dead. So you're dealing with over 250,000 people killed in their war on drugs. That's right. Colombia, it was 220,000 dead. And they killed 3,000 union leaders. And they displaced 6 million Colombians. And they disappeared 45,000. And then in Honduras, 84,000 killed, and really bad gangs down there, and similar to San Salvador. So what you have is you have them being brought into criminal contempt, and they signed that they were guilty. There were hearings. Remember the hearings? They were found guilty. They admitted guilt. They didn't fight it. So they got to pay a fine. The fine was for $1.9 billion. That's 5 weeks worth of profit. That's it. Nobody was arrested. Nobody went to jail. Nobody's reputation was affected. They didn't take away the charter of the corporation, so they couldn't practice. And they got to keep their illicit gains. $800 million they got to keep. So, they're back in business. How is that possible? There's a group, the largest legal group in America is Covington and Burlington. It's an international law firm. They're all over the world. And guess who two of their partners? Well, the people from Lanny Brewer, top person at the Justice Department in criminal and crimes, and Eric Holder, Attorney General. So Eric Holder and Lanny Brewer leave the Justice Department and go right back in as partners into Covington Burlington. You could probably expect between $3 to $5 million a year guaranteed. So why should you know about this? Well, just look at who they represent. All of the big banks, Bank of America, Apple Computer, the defense contractors, John Deere, Eli Lilly, General Electric, Halliburton, IBM, Harley-Davidson, Merck, Microsoft, Morgan Stanley, NASCAR, NBA, NFL, Northrop Grumman, Procter & Gamble, Verizon, Walmart, Axie, formerly Blackwater. And here's an interesting one. Did you know that Eric Holder defended Chiquita, one of their clients, against lawsuits brought by relatives of people slain by terrorists and paramilitary belonging to the United Self-Defense Forces of Colombia, which Chiquita Banana paid for protection? Why didn't anyone know this? This is just one of the links to show you that when you are in that gilded group, you're protected. So here we have HSBC admitting they had committed a crime of money laundering for drug cartels. I gave you the names of the Sinhala and all the other drug cartels. Nobody was found guilty. Nobody went to jail. No reputation was hurt. Wall Street was happy. They paid a $1 billion fine, 5 weeks worth of revenue or income, and business as usual by the very people who then go back and protect them. So these are the too big to jail, not just too big to fail. And that's why you've seen not a single person from Wall Street running a major Wall Street bank found guilty after all the shenanigans and illegalities that occurred during the before the great meltdown in 2007. And it's going to stay that way. And yet 90,000 went to jail for small drug crimes, possession more than anything, and they didn't get a break. So gee whiz, do you think that we have an absurd notion of justice? So when I said years ago, I don't know what year or when that person who's anonymous working on Wall Street heard me, but when I said it is corrupt from beginning to end, its working model is corrupt, the money we made on Wall Street stays on Wall Street. It does not go into middle Americans' pockets. That's why I said it, and I stand by it. Glad that he agrees with that now. Let us now go over to my guest who is standing by. He is over in Qatar. A little bit of background on him because I want you to know the quality of his insights. He is Professor Juan Cole. He is the Richard Mitchell Collegiate Professor of History at the University of Michigan, where he has taught since 1984. And within the progressive political and religious community, he is regarded as one of our leading public intellectuals and historians on Middle East and South Asian affairs. He has degrees from American University in Cairo, Egypt, a doctor from UCLA in Islamic Studies, and is a former editor of the International Journal of Middle Eastern Studies and a member of the editorial board of the Journal of Iranian Studies. He frequently writes for Tom Dispatch and Tycoon and Truth Dig and other publications. He's written over 10 books dealing with Islam and Western colonization in the Middle East and many, many other things, including the New Arabs, how the millennial generation is changing the Middle East. His website is juancole.com. Nice to have you with us today.
Thank you so much, Gary.
Let's take a look at what is happening now in the Middle East, especially since Israel is all over the media for the last 3 days justifying its shooting down and shooting at Syrian troops as well as an Iranian drone, and putting itself once again, as the entire media and all of Congress supports it, as the victim, without any nuance and any fuller picture of what's actually happening in the Middle East. So if you would please, when we look today at Syria, the United States is there and bragged about how we were justified in killing 100 Syrian soldiers. And yet the last time I looked, Syria is still a sovereign nation and did not invite the United States to participate in its fight against ISIS and other terrorist groups. Could you take us through all of what's going on in the Middle East, at least the most important things, and most importantly, focus some attention on Iran? What kind of threat does Iran actually represent, real or existential, to the rest of the world? And why doesn't anyone talk about the fact that the United States and Israel, our National Security Agency, and the Mossad created a malware that would have turned off all electricity in Iraq or Iran, therefore preventing them from knowing that an assault was occurring? And it was only by accident they found out about this. And had Hillary Clinton become president, there is a reasonable hypothesis that she would have greenlit a preventative attack on Iran by Israel, claiming that it was developing or had developed a nuclear device and represented a threat to Israel in the Middle East. And the American media would have gone right along with it. No matter what was said, they would agree with. Your thoughts, please.
Yeah. Well, what's been happening in Syria, I interpret as a fight over spheres of influence. You know, that country doesn't have a unified government anymore. There are large parts of it that have gone out of the control of Damascus. The regime in Damascus has only survived Bashar al-Assad and the Ba'ath Party because they had 300,000 troops, but all but about 50,000 have deserted. They only survived because Iran and Russia came in and backed them against the various forces that were rebelling against them. And they backed them successfully. So the Syrian government has recovered, 70% of the populated areas. You often see a statistic that says that the regime doesn't control more than half the country, but what it doesn't control is mostly desert. Hello?
Yes. What has changed now in the U.S. military policies in the Middle East since Trump came to office, and what is the U.S.'s ultimate agenda, and now Israel's implementing a regime change in Syria?
Yeah, well, neither the United States nor Israel is happy that the Bashar al-Assad government survived. They are not willing to go toe-to-toe with, especially with Russia, and Russia and Iran are both in Syria and backing the central government. So they have different strategies. The Israelis, are occupying the Golan Heights, and they are supporting fundamentalist rebels who control much of the Syrian side of the Golan Heights and into the province of Quneitra. They're even backing a militia that's had links to Al-Qaeda, because they prefer those Sunni fundamentalist rebels to either the Syrian government troops coming back to the Golan Heights, or to Hezbollah establishing bases so near to Israel and overlooking Israel. The Israelis occupy the Golan Heights in part because they feel vulnerable to mortar and other fire coming down on them from up there. So the Iranians flew that drone over towards Israel because they're tracking those Sunni fundamentalist rebels that the Israelis are backing. And their hope, the regime and Hezbollah and Iran, is ultimately to recover all of Syria for Damascus, for the Bashar al-Assad government.
When you take a look at Saudi Arabia today and the United Arab Emirates, they were contemplating an attack or an invasion of Qatar. What is that about, since Qatar has been a close U.S. ally, and also they were supporting the Obama administration?
Yeah, it's the damnedest thing. It's a little hard to understand why the United Arab Emirates and Saudi Arabia came after Qatar that way. It's not just they, it's also Bahrain and Egypt. They cut a little Qatar off from its land routes because it's a peninsula sticking up into the Persian Gulf, and it's the only land border it has is with Saudi Arabia, and they were trucking in, fruits and vegetables from places like Jordan across Saudi Arabia. And suddenly the Saudis closed the border. It seems as though they contemplated invading. They also tried to get up a plot to replace the current ruling family with a minor branch of it that would be a Saudi puppet. They tried to cut off Qatar Airways from flights. They refused to let them be in contact with the air traffic controllers. So the Qataris had to go out and do a deal with Iran to be able to keep its airline going. And then the demands were that Qatar cut off relations with Iran, which is not, Qatar is not close to Iran, but it has to have correct relations with Iran. It's a neighbor, and they share a gas field. That it closed down its Al Jazeera television network, which is the most popular in the Arab world, and that it ceased supporting the Muslim Brotherhood, the fundamentalist group, which was overthrown after coming to power in Egypt through peaceful elections in 2012. So there were all these accusations that Qatar was supporting terrorism, which, you know, it's not. And these drastic measures taken against it, which really were warlike. And then President Trump had been bamboozled by the Saudi crown prince and tweeted out, you know, his support for these measures and blamed Qatar for terrorism. The whole thing was a get-up job. And I think, you know, probably an attempt at a bank robbery, because Qatar is fabulously wealthy, even though it's very small. It's only got 300,000 citizens, but it has a lot of natural gas. And the Saudi government is hurting in many ways. And I think they were trying to grab Qatar.
Well, they grabbed their own. People, over 200 of the wealthiest families in Saudi Arabia, were recently arrested and held in captivity at the Ritz-Carlton there. And now, only after they turned over their assets or paid huge, huge bounties against themselves, were they freed. And someone I read, it said about $200 billion all told was confiscated in the value of corporations that the people in Saudi Arabia had. And this young guy, this young prince whose father is retiring, and he will then become the king of Saudi Arabia. He's an extreme firebrand. He's the one who decided to go into Yemen and destroy Yemen. That didn't work, but it bled them dry financially. Now they're having to borrow money. That didn't work. So you look at Qatar. Qatar has the wealthiest people in the world per population, mainly because they got a lot of money and they have very few citizens, about $140,000 income or value per person, beating the United States or Great Britain for that matter. So what do you think now is the likely outcome of this really irresponsible leader in Saudi Arabia, and how will that portend for the other Arab states?
Well, Saudi Arabia used to be a pillar of stability in the region. It was conservative, but it didn't go around acting like a wild man. And ever since King Salman came to power, and, you know, real power rests in the crown prince, Mohammed bin Salman, who's, you know, in his early 30s. He's a young guy. He's inexperienced. He doesn't know the world very well. And he's just, as you say, been rampaging around. He started this war in Yemen, which is destroying the country, hasn't brought any benefit at all to Saudi Arabia or anybody else. It's a huge humanitarian crisis with millions in danger of starvation and displaced. Then he tried to overthrow the government of Lebanon. He's been involved in backing hardline fundamentalists in Syria. He tried to overthrow Qatar. So you know, I think there's some evidence that, you know, the Saudi government contemplated doing some of these things back in the Obama days, and the National Security Council of the United States told them no. But they no longer have an adult in the room. There's nobody to tell them no, because the Trump administration, nice house, nobody home. So they're able to flex their muscles in these ways. They were behind the destruction of the Arab Spring youth revolutions for democracy. Behind the scenes, they paid off the Egyptian officer corps to make a coup. So they've become a really destabilizing force. They say that they feel surrounded by Iran. But, you know, Iran has a military budget the size of Singapore's. And to the extent that it has gained some influence in the region, it's soft power. You know, it's because they've taken stances that people like. On the other hand, Saudi Arabia is launching wars and twisting arms and engaging in really a violent kind of diplomacy.
When you look at what Saudi Arabia has done as far as its madrasas, it's teaching schools all over the world. They're now the number one Islamic schools in the world, and these are teaching hardline Wahhabist values. These are the beheaders. These are the people who throw gays off buildings. These are the people who don't allow women the rights and believe in strict Sharia. So why don't you ever hear anyone in the media criticizing Saudi Arabia for all of its hostilities, its support of terrorism, and breeding a kind of indoctrinating mindset of Wahhabist values for all these young kids growing up? You don't hear a word about it.
Yeah, it's really quite annoying, the influence that the small and really repressive Wahhabi sect has on the world of Islam because of Saudi's oil riches. Before the oil, they were considered a kind of minor cult, and the mainstream Muslims wouldn't pay any attention to them. But now they have gained a very big megaphone. And as you say, they fund mosques, they fund schools, and their interpretation of Islam is not orthodox. It's not the interpretation that's mainstream in the Muslim world, and it's, as you say, extremely repressive. They tinkered with some Quran translations, to make sure they say that you're not allowed to be friends with Christians and Jews. And they have this blinkered approach to the outside world. And most Muslims are not like that. But the Saudis have gotten this big platform because of their oil wealth. And no, they are never criticized, in mainstream U.S. media or in the State Department, the Pentagon. Nobody comes out and denounces them. They're one of the last absolute monarchies in the world. There's no semblance of democracy in that country. People are sentenced to 1,000 lashes for blogging. You routinely hear U.S. officials come out and say, we can't abide by the human rights abuses in Myanmar or in Iran or in North Korea. But no one ever comes out on the U.S. side and talks like that about Saudi Arabia. It's partly because they're so wealthy and powerful, the world's swing oil producer. They really have a big impact on price. And they're very useful to the United States in that regard. But it's also because, on the whole, by and large, the Saudi government has tried to align itself with U.S. interests. So it's a very reliable ally for the U.S. government and a major source of world petroleum. So it gets a pass, it's one of the great pieces of hypocrisy in American diplomacy that it does get a pass.
Today, Ben Norton from Real News Network released a story about how the U.S. ambassador confirmed the billions spent on regime change in Syria, debunking Obama did nothing myth. The U.S. spent at least $12 billion in Syria-related military and civilian expenses in the 4 years from 2014 to 2017. That's according to U.S. Ambassador Robert Ford. And that does not include the billions spent for additional military and civilian expenses to regime change there. And not a word about this. Also today, I saw a photograph of open-air markets, the largest in the world, where Africans are being sold from other countries that try to get through Libya, and they're captured, and they're being sold into slavery. And I'm wondering, why doesn't anyone say Me Too against Hillary Clinton for what she has done to the women of the world in all these regimes she and her husband supported? And those people are now in the largest slave market in the entire world on the planet. That's hers. her and Obama, not a word of criticism because of the humanitarian disaster they've caused and the suffering they've caused to the people of Libya and the rest of Africa. Your thoughts?
Well, it is a horrible situation in Libya, although, to tell you the truth, it's not quite as bad with regard to security and fighting as Syria. But it's sufficiently in turmoil that there's no governmental authority really that would come in and stop these essentially slave traders from bringing people up from Africa, often under false pretenses, and then more or less selling them or putting them on rickety boats into the Mediterranean. You know, that crisis of people drowning to death trying to get to Europe from the coast of North Africa hasn't gone away. It's still a major crisis, but it's gone off the headlines of the newspapers. And it's just an issue of order, because, you know, those boats don't take off from Egypt or from Tunisia because there's actually a government.
Juan, we're out of time. I appreciate you sharing your insights, and especially today coming from Qatar, because you're giving us a different perspective. Thank you very much, and we look forward to another conversation. Professor Juan Cole from Qatar, I'm Gary Nall, and we're out of time. Thank you all for listening. Have a nice day.